May we proceed, please, to case number one, Patterson versus Crown Foods International.
May it please the court. This case comes here on appeal from a final judgment after a bench trial in the district court. The appeal addresses issues under the Perishable Agricultural Commodities Act, specifically whether a produce supplier, the plaintiff in this case, Patterson Frozen Foods, whether they can qualify for PACA trust protection after extending payment terms beyond 30 days. The district court's findings and conclusions constitute clear error that the court ignored this circuit's most recent case addressing PACA, Greg Orchard, and USDA regulations that prevent assertion of PACA trust rights after a party agrees to extend payment terms beyond 30 days. The district court erred by requiring the parties to have a quote-unquote executed document. The document at issue was a January 8, 1999 repayment plan that the parties had agreed to that extended terms well beyond 30 days. And in fact, it was an eight-month plan. It also included interest calculations at 8.5%. That requirement, the execution of a post-default agreement, does not exist under PACA. It's not required under any case law that I'm aware of, nor the regulation.
There does have to be a written agreement, and I guess, is it your position that any writings that would satisfy the relevant state statute of frauds are enough?
Yes.
We can't read out written from the statute.
No, you don't have to read out written, but we could look at other examples where the reduction to writing is used under the statute, and in this case, it's obvious because the produce transactions at issue were, quote-unquote, reduced to writing. But all that was an invoice that was sent to the parties saying we're going to ship so much produce and you're going to pay that produce within 30 days. That was the term. This post-default extension agreement was exactly the same. The evidence was clear that there were negotiations by telephone. Then there was a faxing of a plan, which is that January 8, 1999 agreement. That fax contained all the terms that would basically remove uncertainties from the agreement. I'm not here to say that all agreements, such as an oral agreement, or we're not making the course of dealing argument here. We're saying that the parties did have an agreement, but all that they were required to do was reduce it to writing, which is in fact what happened, and it's shown in the evidence. In addition to that,
was there any discussion in the district court about whether this writing had the attributes that would satisfy the state statute of frauds?
There was none. There was none, Your Honor.
Was it brought up by either party?
I do not believe. It wasn't brought up at trial.
It shows up, in your view, on the seller's letterhead when the seller is describing it. But who signed that letter? Was it signed by a kind of person who could make it an agreement for purposes of the state statute of frauds?
Well, Patterson, the actual document, the January 8, 1999 agreement, has, in fact, you could say, letterhead on top of it, because on top of the fax it says Patterson Frozen Foods with their identification fax number. Also on there is a fax note that's used as almost a cover sheet, and it's addressed to the defendant, and it's signed by Neil, who at trial was the testimony.
It's signed by whom?
Neil Moroso, who was Patterson Frozen Foods Vice President.
Neil Moroso. So your view is that that's somebody with corporate authority to bind?
He was Vice President. I don't think there's any argument at trial that he had, in fact, signed that document. In addition to that, though, if we look at how Patterson conducts itself after that January 8th agreement, they don't hide from it. They don't say, well, this was just a proposal. I mean, they say at trial, after we raise it for the first time as an affirmative defense, that, well, this wasn't an agreement. This was just a proposal, or this was just the negotiations. But if we look at really what they did from January through the date they filed their complaint in district court, which was, I believe, 8 months after the fact, they communicate with Crown Foods demanding payment pursuant to that January 8th agreement. when and then Crown makes a payment exactly as required, and it's an odd amount. It's like $8,356.46. I mean, it's not an amount that corresponds with any other invoice. Additionally, what they do is they then notify the USDA and say, we have reached an agreement. They use the word agreement many times from January 8th through, I believe it's April, where their final letter, and I stressed this in my brief and I stressed it at trial, their final letter where they basically recap everything that happened, and they say, we reluctantly agreed to extend payment terms to Crown over an eight-month period at 8.5% interest.
But the use of the word agreement doesn't resolve whether it's a written agreement enough for the statute, and Crown, at least Patterson suggests that Crown is in a somewhat, shall we say, awkward position here, because it was Crown that was adamantly refusing to sign anything as an agreement, and they're saying, gee, you know, now all of a sudden when it suits your interests, you're turning around and saying there really is a binding agreement that modified this short-term credit term into a long-term credit term that's outside of PACA. So there's a certain equity, I suppose, that they're arguing here.
Well, that actually occurs not in January. That happens in April when, agreeably, Patterson is upset at Crown because they have, in fact, negotiated in November. I argue reached an agreement in January, made a payment, then made a partial payment. If you look at the correspondence between January and April, you see Patterson saying, you know, your payment's due, and when is your February payment? I mean, your February payment's due, and on top of that, your March payment's late. I mean, they're obviously aggravated at that, and that shows in the record. But the January 8th fax agreement actually occurred or occurs just like all their other transactions up to that point had occurred. There's no signature on those invoices, and the parties understood that to be an agreement as well. There are, I think, seven or eight of them. I think what the district court also did that kind of sidestepped this issue a bit was not addressing the regulations, and specifically 4646E2. Because that section says that the maximum time for which you can extend terms and still qualify for trust protection is 30 days. That is the maximum.
Of course, your adversary says that that's only for an agreement negotiated before the delivery.
I understand that.
This obviously happened after the delivery, so why does it count?
Well, I would argue that any post-default agreement is going to occur after the delivery of
protocol.
And the full payment promptly, the Secretary has defined full payment promptly in the regulations, and they say 10 days, and it's, I think, 46.2. So full payment promptly is 10 days. Then they say if you want to extend in excess of 10 days or different terms, it must be reduced to writing, again, the same argument that we've discussed, but it can be no greater than 30 days. I think what has to happen is the 46.46 has to be read in addition to the definitional sections.
But what policy makes your position sensible? It seems to me, you know, the thing isn't paid in time. Everybody agrees that that's where we begin, in a sense, with this case. And under your position, people who try to resolve their problems with settlement agreements are punished, in a sense, by losing the benefit of the PACA priority and trust protection. And, frankly, what seems to be what this case is really all about, the ability to go after the individuals. And why should we adopt a rule that, in a sense, has this punitive effect toward people who are trying to settle their disputes?
Well, Patterson is not forced to comply under PACA. That's their right, and that's their choice. I mean, that's what they have. They have this very strong act that is there
for
their protection.
Why should we discourage them from doing so?
Well, they have to comply under their terms, though, and the rules that, and the regulations that the Secretary of Agriculture promulgate for that, and that 30-day maximum.
Let me try a different variation of my colleague's question. Why would it ultimately be in the interest of the corporate insiders who are subject to the trust doctrine to encourage sellers not to try to collect from the buyers, but to go immediately against the corporate insiders? That's the burden of your position. Any seller who tries for more than 30 days to get the corporate buyer to pay gives up his entitlement to go against the corporate insiders. Why, in the long run, would that be in the interest of the corporate insiders? I can understand how your client would win.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me people in the position of your client in the future would largely be losers. So why should we take that position?
Well, I think what should have really happened here, what...
I'm not asking what should have happened here. Both Judge Wood and I are asking questions about the policy underlying the statute. And if you have views on that, we'd really like to hear them.
Okay, well, my view on that is that the statute is there to protect short-term credit situations. And a plaintiff such as Patterson, when a defendant such as Crown comes late on their produce debt, has the right under the statute to go to district court and file a lawsuit to protect its rights under that statute. What Patterson did was they waited 6 months after the produce was due.
But you're drawing a short-term, long-term distinction for the people who really need the short-term protection.
That's what I was going to. What is your short-term definition?
Well, the regulations define prompt payment as 10 days with the ability to extend to 30 days. So I would say 30 days is the maximum because it's what the rules and the regulations.
That's your short-term definition.
Short-term would be 30 days.
All right.
And also, not only did they wait 6 months after the produce debt became due, but then they waited another, I believe, 8 or 9 months before they decided to file a lawsuit in district court. If I could, I'd like to reserve the remaining amount of my time.
All right.
Good morning. May it please the court. The key fact here, in my view, is that there's no express written agreement. It was basically a question of fact. The district court saw all the evidence, and that's what they decided.
Well, do you think that the letter failed to satisfy the state statute of frauds?
Yes, when there's proposals back and forth, and
there's a letter under your client's letterhead that says, here's our agreement, and it's signed by Neil Morozo. Now, under the statute of frauds, all that's required is a writing signed by the party to be bound. It doesn't have to be signed by the other party.
Right. Well,
is there any formal defect in this letter so far as the statute of frauds is concerned?
Well, of course, I would point to the PACA, which the regulations have stricter requirements. But as to the
we don't know that. That's part of the question here, and in fact, the net of our opinion in Greg Orchard suggests that maybe this court doesn't think the statute has stricter requirements. Why would we have bothered to remand with respect to plantations if we didn't think that one could prove a written agreement by finding something that satisfies the statute of fraud?
Well, this letter, I mean, I'll admit that Patterson did try at the time to categorize it as an agreement to force payment, but there was no meeting of the minds because neither party, appellants knew they couldn't pay. Patterson was just trying to get them where they wouldn't sign anything. They were just trying to say it's an agreement.
But they did pay down to the penny what was due in the first month. They made a partial payment of $2,000 in the second month.
Right. I mean, they did pay one payment, and Patterson's position is they're just going to apply that to their account. They don't care how they get paid. They've defaulted on the invoices.
Not January after the agreement. Patterson was perfectly happy, it seems, at that point.
Well, they were happy, but the invoices were long past due already, so they really weren't happy. They're just going to apply anything that they get to the invoice amount, which they did. They came up with a plan or a proposal that was never...
A plan that was accepted. I mean, as Judge Easterbrook points out, the plan was something that you proposed and was signed by your vice president, and then we have exchanges of correspondence, then a check comes in down to the penny, for what the plan called for, and so under ordinary principles of contract law, particularly, you know, if you think of the UCC or other sorts of things, that's plenty to say that there's a written contract.
Well, I would say not when you take all the other evidence in connection with that, which is other proposals, and there's a letter 4 months...
But they weren't implemented, the other proposals.
At that time, well, there were...
Ever.
No, they weren't implemented, but there were proposals going back and forth, and Mr. Eckert himself says we made several attempts in April of 1999, 4 months later, but we cannot reach an agreement. That's Trial Exhibit 17. So he admits there was no agreement because at that time he didn't want to be found. Now when he sees that potentially he has a defense, he's arguing that there was an agreement. He never said there was an agreement.
Do you think it's impossible that parties could enter into a contract on January 8th of a year, perform for 2 months, there's then a breach of that contract, and at that point they're arguing about whether some new agreement has come into being? Does it mean there was never a contract if there was, if there's a breach?
No.
That's an interesting theory of contract law.
No, that's not my that's not my theory. My theory is that when the party that's going to be bound never agrees to be bound, they can't later say it was a contract. And your point is taken that they did make a payment. But Patterson's point is they're going to apply any payment to the already defaulted on past due amount, which they did. Appellants can argue that the produce was sold without a written contract. It was just the invoice. But there's not specific regulations or statute that says that you can't have an oral contract for the sale of produce. There is a specific statute and regulations, as you know, and as was fully briefed, that requires an express written agreement to extend terms. Waiving packet rights, Congress has made it clear that this is an important right, especially for California shippers and sellers of produce, that this trust can't be waived easily. You need a lot of things to occur to waive. Another thing that Patterson did is, when they filed their informal packet complaint, which is the administrative agency...
I've missed something. What's special about California here? It's a federal statute.
Right. I mean, I'm just stressing that there's a lot of shippers of produce in California that ship throughout the country. No, there's just nothing special, Your Honor. You're correct. When Patterson filed its informal packet rights, which is before any of this negotiation, Mr. Marosa from Patterson Frozen Foods, the vice president, had the foresight to say, okay, they want to make payments, we'll accept those payments, providing PACA will still be enforced in case respondent defaults.
But, you know, part of what I've thought about that is that this case is about whether he can do that. Your opponent suggests that PACA, which certainly does establish an extraordinary right compared to other sorts of secured rights that creditors might have, was really for the seller of produce who's in a short-term situation. If they don't get paid right away, they're going to be in very bad shape. And perhaps on that policy, one construes it strictly and says anybody who's got the financial wherewithal to create, you know, an 8-month repayment plan or the kind of repayment plan that existed in Greg Orchard isn't the kind of person Congress was worrying about. And therefore, if they choose to go that route, they're outside of PACA.
Well, I still don't buy the long-term, short-term distinction that appellants are trying to make. I don't think that's a valid argument.
Why?
Because the invoices were already defaulted on. And as Your Honors mentioned, that we want to encourage parties. What is someone supposed to do when someone defaults on their invoices? That's it? File an action against the invoice?
The problem here is that this might be a good concern if we were writing on a clean slate, but we're writing on a slate that already has Greg Orchard's on it.
Well, this is unique and this is different from Greg Orchard's, and it's distinguishable in many ways from Greg Orchard's. One of which, in Greg Orchard's, there were executed and signed agreements for two of the plaintiffs. The one that didn't have a signed agreement, they remanded the district court.
Why did they remand? It seems to me, under your theory, they should have just said there's no signed agreement, Plantation loses.
I think they remanded. I don't know the history from that point on, but I think they remanded for findings consistent with that.
Well, but if it's as easy as you're suggesting, that you just flip through the files and you look for something that says contract at the top of the page and it has two signatures at the bottom of the page, I don't know what the need for a remand would be.
Well,
if it's something more like finding whether the statute of frauds has been complied with, the kinds of questions that my colleagues are raising are quite relevant. Who signed it, you know, who proposed it, and so on. There's sometimes facts that need to be found.
Well, I mean, you're right, it's not as clear-cut as that, but when there's a signature line and that's unsigned, that's pretty clear. And then where there's a letter from Crown, I'm not going to quote, but there was Trial Exhibit 17 where they state 4 months after the supposed agreement occurred, that we have made, quote, several attempts at making payment arrangements, and unless we come to an agreement. So they're categorizing it as attempts at that time because they don't want to be bound. Now all of a sudden they see a defense, they see some light, and they're grabbing onto that and now saying that there was an agreement. They can't have it both ways. There was no agreement. There was no meeting of minds. It wasn't reduced to writing. In Greg Orchard's, this court stated, in this case, there is no dispute that the post-default agreement entered into by the parties extended the time for payment beyond 30 days in violation of USDA regulations. There was no dispute. There was a signed document. Here, there is a dispute. All the cases say ambiguities are resolved in favor of the PACA trust beneficiaries.
But the dispute, as you're portraying it, is whether there's enough of a writing. I think you would have to agree that if the January 8th document were enough of a writing, nobody's arguing about the length of time it covers. It sets forth a schedule very much like the one in Greg Orchard's.
Right, if that were sufficient to constitute a written agreement, there could still be some question as to whether that's enough to waive PACA rights, but it would be clear that that could be the outcome. But
I'm just trying to focus on what your key distinction is. I don't think it's the duration. I think it's just whether it's the writing.
No, it's not. It's not the duration. It's the strict requirements to waive PACA, express writing prior to the transaction. Okay, we have Greg Orchard. And there's so many things that need to be met, and I'm saying that there was no real meeting of the minds in this case. There was no real agreement. Appellants point to Lombardo. The invoices in Lombardo specifically state 45 days. That's on its face violation. And then when they defaulted on that, they executed a 20-week payment plan. Davis, Fourth Circuit, parties executed a written security agreement. No doubt or ambiguity. Then they rely on Richmond, Northern District, California bankruptcy case. That case was read as it was to expand PACA trust protection. There were letters. At that time, you had to file a written notice instead of including it on the invoice, which was a 96, I believe, amendment to make it easier to preserve your trust rights. So at that time, they wanted to preserve PACA trust rights by making the default date later. So they read these letters as extending PACA trust rights. But the letter even said, quote, being furnished to satisfy PACA's requirement that there be a written agreement to extend term. Quote, unless debtor objects in writing, this letter will serve as an agreement regarding the payment terms. They did all that. That's different than in this case. In fact, in this case, Mr. Morosa from Patterson said, we'll accept these payments, provided PACA remains in effect. What more is he to do? I mean, he's done everything he can.
Not really. I mean, he could have said, a lot of this depends on when you enter the story, but if it were clear that agreeing to some sort of post-default payment plan that extends beyond 30 days removed your PACA rights, then presumably your client would have made a decision. Do we want the PACA rights, in which case you would have filed right away to protect them, with the kinds of consequences Judge Easterbrook was talking about, perhaps, over the long run, or you would have said, you know, we think we're really going to have a long-term relationship with this company, you know, we'd like to work it out, they seem stronger than we think, and you would have done this. But you would have known you were choosing, and part of the question is, you know, what in fact does this statute provide for this kind of choice? And actually, there's another part of your argument that I think is a little problematic, because the way the statute of frauds works in most states is a bit asymmetrical. You need the writing signed by the person against whom you want to enforce the contract, right? So in a situation like this, it might be possible to enforce against one side and not the other.
I see your point. But actually, right, it depends on who you're saying is trying to enforce this agreement. At one time it was one party, and at another time it was another.
I mean, that was an innovation, right, of the 20th century. Maybe a good one, maybe a bad one, but that happened.
Counselor, are you going to address anything about the attorney fees question?
Briefly, I think that's pretty clear cut. It was no abuse of discretion for the district court to award fees. It's mandatory under 7 U.S.C. 499-TB. Which states if the licensee does not pay a PACA reparation award, which Crown did not, albeit it wasn't against Eckert at that time, PACA reparation, because you can't file with the PACA department an administrative action against him. Crown's the license holder. So Patterson filed against Crown, got a judgment, they didn't pay, so Patterson had to file the district court action. at that time, Crown's now defunct, they named Crown also. The statute doesn't say anywhere that you can't add additional parties. It just says if you have to file a district court action to enforce a PACA reparation rights order, then you're entitled to attorney's fees. It's mandatory.
Appellant well, how can you hold Eckert personally responsible?
Well, even if we don't, if we just hold Crown liable, it becomes part of the PACA trust claim, and then Eckert will be personally liable. Because
okay.
Sums owed in connection with the produce transaction are protected under the PACA trust, and that's right in the statute. And, in fact, the Greg Orchard's underlying decision also said that, which was reversed, but not on those grounds. My position is that it's mandatory and that it becomes part of the PACA trust claim. As to the invoices, they say 18% service charge. The district court failed to see that and awarded 10% interest.
But you didn't cross appeal.
I did not cross appeal.
You can't get more than you got on the appeal.
Well, my argument would be that the invoices are in the record already and that...
That doesn't make any difference. If you want something more than what you got in the district court, you have to cross appeal.
Okay, well, you're correct. I didn't cross appeal, so I would drop that argument then. But...
That makes sense.
So, in conclusion, I would just argue that all the cases are distinguishable for obvious reasons. The purpose of the reduced to writing requirement is to, quote, remove uncertainties as to the applicable payment terms, end quote. That's from the Richmond case. There's still uncertainties here. Obviously, the parties don't agree. Testimony proved it. The district court agreed. We can't have a presumption in favor of the buying party. The presumption's in favor of the PACA trust beneficiaries. Congress made that clear in all of the legislative history. And that's how I would want a finding to be consistent with. Thank you.
Right, counsel.
I'd like to briefly address the attorney's fees issue because I would agree with counsel if the trial court had said that based upon count three and count four of the complaint, which were addressing the actual PACA trust or breach of fiduciary duties claim. If the trial court had said, I'm going to award attorney's fees based upon that, there could be a right for attorney's fees. But the trial court didn't do that. The trial court provided for fees based upon solely the reparation award and nothing else. It's not a broad award of attorney's fees that counsel now argues. The district court was very, very specific and said, based upon the statute and the citation goes right toward the reparation award, fees should be awarded against Phil Eckert individually. We think that's an abuse of discretion because Phil Eckert wasn't a party.
Can you come back to the roundabout route? Does the trust fund obligation cover everything that's in a reparation award?
I'm not aware that it is or it isn't, Your Honor. I'm not certain on that issue.
Well, but that's the way your adversary seeks to uphold the award of attorney's fees. We really need to know the answer to that question.
I understand. My answer would be that at the point of trial, the only defendant in the case was Phil Eckert when trial started.
What does that have to do with anything?
Because the award was based upon a count that wasn't in the complaint.
How does that answer the question whether the trust fund covers everything that's part of a reparation award?
I'm not sure it does, Your Honor.
Okay. Non-responsive.
The final issue is the statute of frauds, and I would like to argue that there can be other ways to, or you can look at more than just one document when interpreting whether there's a writing. We could look at the writing of the check, the cashing of the check in the exact amount, the other writings where Patterson admits the terms. And there are two documents in the record that are important. It's the reparation of a complaint and then the amended reparation complaint, which is a sworn pleading where Neil Moroso lays out again those specific terms, and we would argue that those are sufficient to establish a post-default agreement that would meet the burden of this court and the burden of the Illinois or any statute of frauds, and we would request that this court reverse the trial court's decision and enter judgment in favor of the defendants. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We will take the case under advisement. Proceed to case number 2, please.